Hello, I'm Liz Shannon Miller, and welcome to a new installment of Liz Tells Frank Live. Liz Tells Frank What Happened in 50 Shades of Grey, featuring Frank Smith and a wonderful live studio audience, was recorded on January 23rd, 2015, at Nerdstrom Gym in North Hollywood, California. Be aware that the following contains adult language and themes, and that certain moments may be enhanced if you also check out the accompanying slideshow on YouTube. Please enjoy Lauren Ludwig's wonderful introduction for the evening, and then prepare to discover the secret origins of publishing wunderkind, 50 Shades of Grey. In your eyes, I touch on you more and more every
time. When you leave, I'm begging you. Thank you guys. Thank you guys. Thank you, Liz Tells Frank, for having me here to tell you guys the absolutely true story of the genesis of Liz Tells Frank. Many, many years ago, in an age when gods still held sway in the hearts of men, when Zeus and his pantheon controlled the ebb and flow of mortal life as the moon controls the sea, in this time there lived a queen, a mortal woman, who was the sole leader of a tiny city-state to the north of Athens. Her name was Queen Liz Milarakis. Queen Liz began her reign at an early age, and with no authority figure to guide her, grew up selfish and proud. She deemed all suitors beneath her and denied the common people wine and figs. Queen Liz was particularly mean to her household slaves, the most lowly and pathetic of which was named Frankilus. Alone in her marble palace, Queen Liz loved but one thing in life: popular culture. Plays, epic poems, mask work. Queen Liz enjoyed it all with equal gusto. But sadly, Liz grew selfish and stubborn in her love of the arts. One night, when the person she was sitting next to at the amphitheater refused to acknowledge that the works of Aeschylus had weak female characters, Queen Liz grew tired of public discourse about entertainment. She proclaimed that it was now illegal for anyone but her to enjoy the arts. Reading of histories, carving of statues, this would now be done only for Liz in the privacy of the palace. And to make matters worse, Queen Liz patently refused to recount the plots of any of this art to others. "That sounds tedious and like a lot of work for me," she exclaimed. This state of affairs was especially tragic for Frankilus, her lowly slave, for he had always loved the works of Sappho. As years passed, Queen Liz's singular knowledge of popular culture grew, but so did her hubris and pride. One day, after a particularly rousing solo mask workshop, Queen Liz announced to no one in particular, "I am the most informed person in all of Greece with regards to popular culture. Not even Athena herself knows more about entertainment trivia than I." Before Queen Liz had uttered the "I" in "I," a crack of thunder split the sky, and in a shower of golden light, Athena was before Liz. "Queen Liz," bellowed Athena, "you have offended me, and thus my father Zeus. If you are so well learned in the sphere of popular entertainment, then I command that you compete against me in a test of knowledge." "Name the time and place," boasted Liz, and thus, on the appointed day, Athena and Queen Liz battled in the public square. The nine muses served as judges and wrote up the trivia questions. The battle was a long and hard one. Queen Liz knew her mosaics, but Athena knew them too. Queen Liz could mostly sum up the Odyssey pretty well, but that's also about how well Athena could sum it up. After many, many hours, just when it seemed the battle of wits would rage forever, Queen Liz's mortal form was tested when the muse of tragedy asked the question, "In the year 1998, actor Ryan Gosling will play which legendary Greek hero?" Queen Liz balked. "What? That hasn't happened yet. Who is Ryan Gosling?" Athena laughed cruelly. "Foolish mortal, you have learned the limits of your power. The answer is young Hercules." "Now, as punishment for your selfish hoarding of popular entertainments and your hubris, I command that you make art available to all again. And furthermore, for the rest of time eternal, you will be compelled to retell any entertainments you watch or read to your slave Frankilus and his future descendants." "Wait," clarified Liz, "are you saying I'm immortal?" "Yes, but in a super curse way." "Oh, Also, I have some rules regarding this curse. One, when you tell Frankalus and his descendants about stuff, you must do it in a public forum in North Hollywood. To increase your shame and to remind you of the day that you were bested in public by me, Athena. Two, at these public forums, the audience should be encouraged to chime in with their own thoughts and questions about the piece of popular entertainment you're telling Frankalus about. Three, if the audience wants to chime in, they must use a bell system you have installed at your own expense. This bell system must be manned by a bell master. The bell master's job is to notice when someone's hand is raised and to alert you, Liz. The audience members should also be warned that they must wait for you, Liz, to call on them before speaking. This is imperative for maintaining order, Athena bellowed. She continued, lastly, if the audience brings communication devices to the event, be they tablets, scrolls, quills, phones, or tablets, these devices should be silenced, though live tweeting is encouraged. This will make sense in the future! Athena screamed as Liz cowered. Thus, Queen Liz, your fate is sealed, Athena concluded, perhaps by spending eternity telling Frankalus and his progeny about various things, you will learn humility, empathy, and the reason that novels like 50 Shades of Grey exist. Or perhaps you will not. Some things are meant to be a mystery. And so, dear citizens, we now gather to watch Liz, currently aged 2,643 years, and Frank Smith, the youngest living descendant of Frankalus, as Liz enacts her ancient and ceaseless curse. Friends and countrymen, please put your hands together for Liz Tells Frank at Live at Nerd, Live at Nerdstrom. Yay!
Damn. Lauren Ludwig, everybody. Good Lord.
It's all true.
It's a true story. I look good, though, for my age, I think.
Oh, amazingly well-preserved.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Okay, so we should just get into this one.
Let's dive in.
All right, Frank. We're going to talk about 50 Shades of Grey. Oh,
this illustration has already told a lot.
Yeah, Frank, things are going to get sexy in here. Or are they? That's really a question. And I really struggled with how to get you through this because there were a couple of different paths. And I think I want to start from the very beginning. I want to start as far back as humanly possible, so you can understand the path that led us to this place we're in now and feel even worse about it, I guess.
Okay.
So here's the basic timeline of how 50 Shades of Grey came to be. We start in the year 1918. I swear to God, we stew. When the first vampire tale is ever told, and it actually is kind of sexy. The Vampire, which is from 1918 and by a guy whose name I had written down at one point and have not apparently saved anywhere, but it's about like this nobleman who is a vampire who comes to town. And he's intriguing to all the ladies, but then he kills a couple of them and then blows town. That's a very, I very much skimmed the Wikipedia entry on this story, but yeah, that's what happens. But it's got a sexy edge to it, and it is actually considered the kind of beginning of the romantic vampire genre. Loads of sexy vampire media thus ensue. I have chosen, as this one example, a Swiss pop song. Vampires are true story,
I discovered this song because I was watching the 2007 Eurovision contest where this song represented Switzerland in the finals. It was actually really wonderful. There was explosions and backflips and lots of dancing vampires, as many as in that video. It was wonderful. Anyways, so in 2005, we get to Twilight. I'm just skipping right to Twilight, guys. We're not even going to talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, even though we could spend some time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. The key difference here is that Twilight is published in 2005, and Twilight, unlike Buffy the Vampire Slayer, is a relatively chaste story at the beginning, despite the fact that it immediately builds a pretty intense fandom of young women, mostly, who are like, I'm super into this vampire and this human getting together. Unfortunately, and this fervor is only built by the ensuing film starring two very attractive people who manage to, on camera, act like they don't actively despise each other. And it's one of those like self-perpetuating cycles. Like it's they make five movies in five years, which is a Woody Allen level work ethic.
Productivity, yep.
And you know, so the movies come out, and then the books come out, and then the movies come out, and the books come out. So there's an overlap, but that overlap kind of gets weirdly thwarted for the fans who have become really obsessed with the series in 2008. 2008 is where things get interesting in terms of the fans who really cared about Twilight online specifically. Because in Breaking Dawn, Bella and Edward get married. It is the last book in the franchise. We have literally been waiting three whole books for this to happen. And they have remained chaste as vaguely chaste-ish, as chaste as a Mormon author will let them be, which is pretty damn chaste. So the thing about them finally getting married and finally thus getting to have consensual, what's the word for married sex?
Intercourse. Consummation.
Consummation, like legally, I don't know.
A routine.
All of that. But the thing is, up until this point, Stephanie Meyer, the author, has never established what the rules are for fucking in the Twilight universe between a human and a vampire. Like, this is all kind of a mystery. It's just assumed weird, I guess. Or not like humans do. Turns out, Twilight sex is really weird sex. Very specifically, Bella and Edward fuck on their wedding night. It is violent and pretty uncomfortable for everyone involved. It's like fucking a Klingon, except that the Klingon doesn't make you breakfast in bed in the morning and just feels really guilty about the fact that he's a vampire and has totally fucked up your vagina. And the best part then is that you get super pregnant right afterwards, like, and your vampire baby is killing you from the inside, and then your vampire husband has to tear the fetus out with his teeth in order, because that's the only way to permeate the uterus that is carrying the vampire. I'm sorry. I promised someone that this would get super weird and gross, and I've clearly failed right away. I'm not making any of this up, by the way. One of my all-time favorite memories is that at Comic-Con, I somehow was in a New Moon panel, and my excuse is that I was seeing, Frank, I was waiting to see the first footage ever from the film Avatar, and the panel before was the New Moon panel, so I was like, yes, job, I will cover the New Moon panel if it means I get to watch Sigourney Weaver talk about her character in the third person after watching 15 minutes of 3D footage. That looked actually pretty cool. I don't know. It was fun to remember. It's fun to remember Avatar as like something we were actually excited about seeing. Yes.
Did it ruin Avatar for you to have to sit through that panel?
No, because it had this one amazing moment in it where Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson playing the leads were asked what scene they were most looking forward to filming from the future movies,
and they said the birth scene from the final book. I was like, you guys get it. You actively hate what you have given birth to. So, anyways, Twilight sex was really weird and not particularly sexy, it turned out. It turns out that having sex in the Twilight universe is immediately awful.
Just quick comparison, better or worse than Avatar sex?
Oh. Less bloody. Mm-hmm. Yep. Then, oh, Avatar sex is less bloody. Mm-hmm. But also Avatar sex is more weird. Mm-hmm. This is an important distinction, the weird bloody line. And I don't know what kind of spectrum I want any of my sex on that. But because all of a sudden, like, you know, you're reading this, you know, these fans are reading these series and they're like, well, I wanted to read about these characters fucking. Like, that's all I'm really invested in. And so I'm just gonna fuck this. I'm just gonna write fanfic about them outside of this universe. And I've now used the word fanfic for the first time in this presentation, and it's really important that we dig into that because, so who in this audience, who, Frank, do you need me to explain fanfic to you?
No.
Okay, okay.
Frank wrote a play about fanfiction.
That is true.
I didn't want to call Frank out on that. But Frank did write a play about fanfiction. That's a thing that Frank's actual friends know about him. Nyla, you had your hand up.
I need to explain.
Okay. Great. All right. So fan fiction is the concept of you are engaged with a story and a narrative, but you want to kind of create your own narrative within that universe. And so to clarify this, I'm going to show you some examples of people who have written fan fiction. Anyone who has written a Sherlock Holmes story who is not Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle created Sherlock Holmes. That character is technically in the public domain. Anyone who's ever written a Sherlock Holmes story is technically, has technically engaged with the narrative and written his own interpretation or her interpretation of the characters, and so on and so forth. So another example is anyone who's written about Jane Austen characters who is not Jane Austen. Another idea, anyone who's written about Greek mythology who's not Greek. Would say that it depends. It would depend, but I feel like there's definitely room to interpret them in that way. Like, if you're bringing your own experience as a creator to somebody else's pre-existing narrative, there is that room for interpretation. A lot of people who study fan fiction like to compare it to the fact that, you know, in Greek times, people would sit around making up new stories about Hercules because, you know, there wasn't television. So that's what they had to do. They had campfires and they had this guy named Hercules who was really strong.
What if Hercules and Perseus and Theseus all teamed up and took an awesome boat ride together?
Exactly. So, and this is a cheap shot, but whatever. Anyone who's written about people in the Bible who is not God. Maybe has written fan fiction. So we're gonna have a little moment of honesty. We're not a large group of people. No one else is looking. By this definition, who here in this room has written fan fiction? It's okay. You don't have, and if you have, and you don't feel comfortable raising your hand, you don't have to say it. You understand. We're not, when we talk about 50 Shades of Grey, this is the reason I want to make a big point about fan fiction right up top. When we talk about 50 Shades of Grey, we are not making fun of it because it is fan fiction. We are making fun of it because it is shitty fan fiction. So, just to be clear. So, enter the fanfic of the Twilight universe, going back to Twilight. And here's the very specific thing that here's how very specifically the Twilight universe reacted to Breaking Dawn and the complete fucked upness of its fanfiction of its sexuality treatise or whatever. They started creating the writers who wanted to write about their favorite Twilight characters fucking created what were called all human alternate universes. And the idea is taking your Barbie dolls, and instead of your Barbie dolls, one of your Barbie dolls being a vampire, you're just like, oh no, my Barbie doll's now just a regular human. And then we put them in all these other different scenarios, and they don't, like, so, and it's just, it basically, it's a way for them to write about their favorite characters without having to deal with the weird sex shit that Stephanie Meyer just forced upon them. And more specifically, read about their favorite characters fucking. Or write about their favorite characters fucking. And because it's a, in the fandom community, works in a cycle. It's people write, people read, and they're, in theory, it's a loving, collaborative opportunity for people to express their love for a certain genre. I found out about the weirdness of the Twilight community through this really great Reddit post that really broke it down in an important way. The quote I'm going to pull from this larger quote that is on the slide right now is, by that point, everyone was just frustrated. We just wanted to create some and consume some fucking porn. Give us a break. And apparently, by a certain point in the Twilight fan community, like 2009-2010, pretty much the majority of all Twilight erotic fan fiction and fan fiction in general was about all human universes. That's according to this Reddit post, which, and I mean, Reddit, guys, it's a very reliable resource. It's no Wikipedia, which I have to remember to mention to you Wikipedia in a minute, Frank, because I know you're going to enjoy it. So anyways, so now we're in the year 2009, and Master of the Universe begins. I am really sorry that it has nothing to do with He-Man. It is...
For now.
Master of the Universe... Yes.
Do you feel like it would have been better if it included He-Man?
Oh, 100%. The question was, do I think it would have been better if it included He-Man? And yes. I stand by my 100%. So this is literally a screenshot from the title page for Master of the Universe. Somebody sent me a PDF. It no longer officially exists anywhere on the internet. It was pulled down for reasons that will become obvious in a little bit. But it is credited to, I'm literally, I have to squint, Snow Queen's Ice Dragon, and includes the subtitle of 50 Shades of Fucked Up, which is how we get to our title eventually. And it is about how young Bella Swan, a college student, meets an industrial tycoon. What's his name?
Edward.
Thank you, Edward Cullen.
And
what?
Oh, Cullen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they enter into a BDSM relationship. So here's the thing. So Snow Queen's Ice Dragon. I apologize for getting her name wrong. Is the pen name at that point of a woman named E.L. James, who is fandom enemy number one at Nick. To this day is now the Twilight enemy's greatest villain. And I love that. I love that the shot I found of her is right in front of a poster for 50 Shades of Grey, the classical album. Because nothing says erotic BDSM like original classical music. I think you've always known that, Frank.
Yeah, I haven't seen Amadeus, but I saw the poster and there was some freaky mask stuff. So, does that make sense?
Yeah. And to clarify why she is not a particular fan of the now kind of desiccated Twilight fandom community, we have this helpful slide series, How to Turn Your Fanfic into a Best-Selling Novel Series and Piss Off All Your Old Fandom Friends. Step one, identify a popular fandom trend and then write a story within that genre. In this case, BDSM. A lot of people apparently gave 50 Shades of Grey some flack for being a ripoff of The Secretary, the Maggie Gyllenhaal, James Spader movie. Oh God, that was back when James Spader was hot. Yeah.
That happened so quickly.
I know, it was a really fast changeover to current day James Spader.
He's doing great.
He's getting work, but... anyways, so there was apparently another story within the Twilight fandom. I have an old coworker friend of mine found out I was doing 50 Shades of Grey for this next List Tells Frank, and she was like, "Liz, we're done." She was so mad. And so I messaged her. I was like, okay, Cindy, we apparently have something to talk about. And she was like, I knew this bitch. And in the fandom circuit at the time, so a lot of this is confirmed by her as vaguely truthful. I'm sure E.L. James is a different side of the story. Maybe one day I'll get it. But anyways, there was another story within the Twilight fandom, according to my friend Cindy, who was a much better written story, much more popular, until E.L. James comes in. And E.L. James actually plays a really interesting game, which, all these stories are being posted to sites like fanfiction.net, and the deal with fanfiction.net is, let's say you put up, like, a 200,000-word epic in one big chunk. You wouldn't get a lot of traffic from it. But if you post short, frequently updated chapters to that site, then you're constantly having new stuff arise, and you're constantly at the top of, like, the recently updated lists, and thus you're constantly having people read you, and you become massively popular within your own, with your own individual fan base. It's not just people who are like, I like Twilight, I'll read anything Twilight. It's like, I'm a Master of the Universe fan. By the way, I have to think every time I say Master of the Universe to make sure I'm not saying Masters of the Universe.
Oh, it's incredibly disorienting.
I really want it to be about He-Man. It'd be so much better. Yes?
Do you think it would still be better if it was a story about He-Man and She-Ra?
Whoa.
In a BDS.
Taboo.
The entire same story. The entire, hold on. The entire same story, but with He-Man and She-Ra is what you're saying. All right, Jeff.
They are brother and sister. What are you talking about? That is insane. Did you see The Secret of the Sword? Holy cow.
Lauren.
And my follow-up was, have you thought about writing your own fan fiction about what if she had put He-Man into?
I think what I would want to write, if I was, the question is, would I want to write about E.L. James writing He-Man into Master of the Universe? And I think the answer to the question is, I think we've made the Shakespeare in Love joke before here, where I would do the Shakespeare in Love treatment, where it's about, I would write fiction about E.L. James writing Master of the Universe. Is that what you're asking for? That's, yes. So I'm a British PR executive with a husband who writes for television. Actually, my life as E.L. James is pretty good so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can put myself into that world.
My working title for the earlier pitch is By the Flowers of Grayskull in the Attic.
Everything is so sad.
I think this is just a free space for us to congratulate.
There's no judgment in brainstorming. Oh, God. So anyways, once you've become massively popular, and thanks to kind of gaming the system with your terribly written fiction, you pull down the fan fiction version of the story, but then also go, hey, guys, remember how much you love me and love my work? Well, you should totally fucking get to work buying my novel, the new version on Amazon. And then you completely shun the original fandom, and you roll around your money. There's at least one year where I think she made more money than J.K. Rowling, and which is just kind of a horrifying thought. Just horrifying. So, yes, as we said, Master of the Universe gets a facelift in 2011. It gets 11% of a facelift. This is according to a site called Dear Reader, ran both the original Master of the Universe text and 50 Shades of Grey through one of those plagiarism services that catches cheating college students, and 11% difference. And if you just think about how many times character names are said in the dialogue, and by the way, they're said a lot, because
that's
11%. Yeah, it's not good. So that takes us to 50 Shades of Grey as it currently exists. Frank, you got any questions?
No, I really did wake up this morning thinking, I've just heard so much about how this book is terrible. What is the crazy confluence of events that let, like, this piece of fan fiction be the one that broke out? Like, I can understand how this particular moment, it's like exactly as e-readers are becoming popular. I can understand, like, female-driven erotic fiction having a big heyday. But the fact that, like, this apparently terribly written book succeeded, yeah.
I mean,
I feel like you've explained everything, and it's just been the most depressing series of explanations that could possibly lead to this endpoint.
I think, and I totally agree with you. And I think a big part of that is the whole, like, you know, the rosy, happy, sunny idea of fandom. Like, you know, in this Reddit post, it is like, it seems like a really happy community of women who don't even really like Twilight that much. Apparently, like, there's, I think, a quote from it. It's like, nobody hates Twilight like a Twilight fan. They just, for some reason, this was just the thing that hooked them into fandom culture. And this was the thing that got them excited about writing fan fiction. And when it came to pass that Twilight was really, really fucking dumb, as revealed in 2008 with Breaking Dawn, they were already kind of pot committed. They were like, we don't want to learn a new fandom. We don't want to learn a new thing. Like, so it's like this happy community kind of got totally steamrolled by a lot of things. But yeah, so now that we're in a really happy place, here's what 50 Shades of Grey is actually about. This won't take long. So, this is Anastasia. She is totally not Bella / Kristen Stewart. In the film, I'm using film stills here because I don't need to look at that many pictures of Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson because I work on the internet. I see plenty of them.
I live on
the internet. So this is Dakota Johnson, who is a person whose name I'm constantly trying to remember. She is the daughter of Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith, which is a fact you will forever remember after I reveal to you that Melanie Griffith sent a congratulatory tweet to her daughter about getting cast as the lead of 50 Shades of Grey. She's like, congratulations from your mom on getting that porn film that you really needed. Anastasia is kind of, I don't know, she's like, she's shy and she's awkward, but wow, if only some guy would notice the really perfect person she is. There's a lot of extra character development that E.L. James brought to the character of Anastasia from the Twilight universe.
Yeah.
She really grew the character into something new and special.
Her name has so many more syllables now.
It does. Okay, and now we have Christian Grey, who is totally not Edward / Robert Pattinson, and he is a mogul of a major company who is Anastasia. Sorry, wow, Freudian slip there. Anastasia goes to interview for her college newspaper. She's like doing a favor for her sick friend, and they have an electric connection, and then, I don't know, they fuck. When I was reading the first book, I've only properly read the first book in this series, because there are three of them, and fuck them. I took pretty decent notes, largely to make sure I didn't have to read it more than once. And it's like you can get into like when is one act of sex different from a different act of sex. But 17 times seemed to be my count. I don't know. Other people might disagree. Let's please have an argument about how many specific times.
No.
So, the thing, of course, and the reason we are talking about this today is that it is not just any sex. It is. It is what is defined in this book as BDSM. It is very much drawn. It is essentially, Christian actively tries to seduce her, and in the seducing of her, is like, look, I want to fuck you, but I only fuck people on a certain set of terms, which includes a legal document dictating a lot of specific elements, like how much you are allowed to eat, how many times a week you work out, and all of the things I am allowed to do to your body. And it is, yeah, it's so dumb. especially because they actively start having sex before she starts before she signs the document, and I'm actually not totally sure she signs the document in book one. I kind of, yes.
Did she have her lawyer review the contract?
It is even worse than that, because I literally was reading this like, I know lawyer people. I should have lawyer people review this contract and be like, this is complete bullshit. But then I didn't even get to do that. She killed my joke. Fucking E.L. James was like, and like after like the 20 pages of detailed instructions about what this relationship is supposed to be, is like, well, it's not a legally binding contract. In the dialogue, he's like, it's not official. I just want us to be on the same page.
How did this guy get so far in business with such poor negotiating?
Christian Grey, the business person, is something we're going to get into. And I just, it takes one thing to really nail this. It's also, as has come up, it's kind of easy to beat up on the writing here, but it is worth mentioning that this book is really badly written. It's Inner Goddess is, I think, the classic, like, pull quote phrase. It is how she has a dialogue, essentially with her own sexuality, about, like, it's like, my inner goddess cried out in excitement, et cetera, et cetera. And again, at least mentioned 25 times. That's as many times as I highlighted in my Kindle. Yes.
Is inner goddess a metaphysical term or just her vagina?
I think it's a metaphysical vagina.
In book three, is there a scene where she fights her inner goddess? Like, maybe in like a junkyard.
Like Dark Knight Returns.
My understanding of psychology is very limited.
I'm just really amused by the idea of her. Yeah, that's. Sorry, just like what I'm trying to figure out is if her vagina is Batman or Superman in the junkyard fight. Yes, there is a question.
So how about rewriting like the Julia fanfic where the inner goddess is actually like.
The question is, what if the inner goddess is like Dexter's dark passenger? Frank, do you know enough about Dexter to speak to that? Because I do not know enough about Dexter.
I don't. Does he have an imaginary friend? Because now I'm significantly more interested in Dexter.
Yes.
I just
want to
say I think that suggestion is awesome.
The audience agrees that the suggestion is awesome. I think based on context clues, I think we're talking about the same situation. Jeff.
Okay, great crossover idea. Anastasia's inner goddess versus Dexter's battle of the century.
They fall up.
And then Dexter's dark passenger and is Anastasia's inner goddess fall in love was the audience comment there. And hopefully fuck, Jesus Christ.
But gently and lovingly.
Gently and lovingly. Yeah, there's for a book about BDSM, it's actually kind of inconsistent about how rough the sex is. And we had one more question, I think, for you, sir.
I was just going to suggest that the inner goddess is Tyler Durden.
The suggestion is that the inner goddess be Tyler Durden, and that is the first idea of the evening that I officially feel like I want to write.
This is what I'm saying about a free, open space of ideas.
Yeah. We aren't judging. We're just like letting the dialogue flow free. All right. So here are some sexy moments in book one. I actually legitimately was like, okay, were there parts of this book that were actually arousing, or not arousing, but like I was like, this is not like unpleasant to read. The third sex scene, so this is two sex scenes after, by the way, he shoves inside her, taking her virginity, while she gasps something along the lines of, "Whoa!" Yes, in the back.
Did she say that, or did her inner mouth?
I think it was kind of, the question is, did she say that, or her inner goddess say that? I think it's kind of a mutual wah.
Yeah.
I bet somebody here actually remembers the exact phrasing. I don't know. It's a popularly quoted phrase.
Is it arg?
Arg. Thank you. It is in fact arg. Yes.
I was hoping it was like Kathy and she said, ah!
50 Shades of Kathy is also.
Oh my God. But anyway, sex scene number three, it's your pretty basic erotic. She goes down on him, he goes down on her. It was pretty generic, but it was fine. Like, I didn't find anything objectionable about it. Nothing seemed like emotionally scarring as a reader. Yeah. And then, yes, Nyla.
Do they do it at the same time?
No, it is not a 69, and they take turns. yes.
So is the definition of sexy for the purposes of this argument not emotionally scarring?
We are in fact working with the basic principle of it's not emotionally scarring and thus sexy. All right, so sex scene number six by my count is he gives her some element of control. Again, this is way before before they've signed the contract, because again, I don't even actually remember when they signed the contract. I don't know if they signed the contract. The contract, again, is really fucking dumb. but it was, I had this passage, I had the passage highlighted, and I had it highlighted, and it was like, oh, this is like a nice, and I reread through the passage. I was like, this feels like a sex scene written by someone who has had sex before and didn't find the experience entirely unpleasant. So, and yeah, that's basically it. Because at a certain point, as it's becoming clear, Frank, we move into like the more of the fake BDSM elements, or the elements that are just like, it is him deliberately manipulating her into a dominant-submissive relationship, her, in theory, being willing to go for it, but it comes with a lot of emotional abuse, and it comes with a lot of like him being like pressuring her into stuff, et cetera. It's not sexy. And I mean, really, just sexy moments in quotes include all the Red Room stuff, which is, the Red Room is his secret, his dungeon. It's called the Red Room of Pain, because that's a sexy name for something. And it's like he tells her to go in and pose and all this stuff, and it's, again, not sexy. It's a lot of it is, feels like somebody watched, like, I don't know.
Read the back cover of a Clive Barker.
Exactly. It's like if you asked me at the age of 15 to describe what BDSM sounded like, I'd be like, I'd probably flash back on that Rosie O'Donnell movie, Exit to Eden. Which, I don't even know if I'd see, I think I've seen
Gary
it.
Marshall's Exit to Eden.
I just remember that they wore like leather studded stuff on the box at the video store, and never actually think. I think I saw it. I know, actually, I have seen it. I know that the last line of the movie is Rosie O'Donnell saying that she got the hot guys from the sexy resort to paint her house. Spoiler alert for Exit to Eden. They also probably solved the crime that they broke into the, I don't know. Again, this is that, it's that level of like somebody's looked up on the internet. Oh, and this is where it comes, this is where I want to mention Wikipedia. When Christian Grey is trying to introduce her to this world of BDSM, Frank, do you know what he tells her? He tells her, always start with Wikipedia. That's how he tells her to learn more about.
I gotta say, that's another sexy moment for me in this book.
I know how you love Wikipedia. I just hope that if you're trying to coerce somebody into a vaguely one-sided BDSM relationship,
I would say do your research.
Yeah.
Check the citations.
You gotta check the crosstalk and the updates.
Yeah.
Citation needed, man. There's also a lot of super cute stalker stuff in this, where it's just like he's just constantly like, aside from the part where, oh, I'll get to that in a second, but it's like this thing where it's like she moves from her college town to Seattle. He knows where she lives. In future books, he figures out where she's just gotten a job. He buys the company so he can control the company and like her boss and her interactions with her boss very specifically. It's so controlling, and it's just one of those things where it's like the only love this woman has ever known is this sort of obsessive, like this is what she understands as sexual attraction, and it's genuinely upsetting at some points, like, and especially because she tries to brush it off with jokes, like literally when she moves to Seattle, her Christian finds out her address. She has not told him her address, and sends her and her roommate a bottle of champagne. Her roommate says, "Wow, that's what a stalker would do. At least it's pretty good champagne." I'm not making that up. Oh God, I'm sorry. We all seem really sad. I'm.
If you looked up stalker on Wikipedia, would it say send champagne to people?
If we looked up stalker on Wikipedia, would it say send champagne to people? I mean, yes, but then you would have to go and check the citation to make sure that it wasn't C. Gray as the username on that edition. Yes.
I think the answer is yes in 5 minutes.
The answer is yes. Somebody will be editing Wikipedia here in 5 minutes. It will be deleted in 6 minutes, but God bless you for doing so. Yes.
I have to go back to the red room. It's not like the red tent.
is that the thing where like the ladies have to go during their monthlies?
Uh-huh.
We're gonna get to that. Yes.
It's like the red room of Twin Peaks. Is there a midget and is everyone talking about?
The red room in Twin Peaks is sexier than the red room. Give me a midget and Kyle MacLachlan any day. All right. I kind of touched on this, but like again, this contract includes things like Christian just constantly harassing her about how much she eats, and she's like, "I'm not hungry. I don't want to eat a full meal right now." And he says, "No, you're going to eat a full meal right now." And he also likes to ply her with alcohol from time to time, you know, like you do. And literally tells her at certain points, like, "Yes, I'm actively getting you drunk right now because I want you to tell me the truth." Yes.
Is Christian friends with Bill Cosby?
Oh! If Christian is not friends with Bill Cosby, he's reading from his playbook. Apparently, actually, somebody did a break. I found an infographic on 50 Shades of Grey that like tracked how much alcohol she drinks. And a lot of times, by the way, she is not getting it for herself. She is being served it by Christian. And apparently, it's like 6 drinks a day, which is like about, I think right now the recommendation is like 2. I say recommendation, like, you know, your doctor says you should have 2 drinks a day. Yeah. At least 2. So, again, really the contract in general is just awful. And especially because it's not even, like, a really interesting dramatic plot point. It just is, because it doesn't really go anywhere. It's just, like, a constant thing for them to bicker about over email. Oh, we're going to get to email, by the way. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. And, sorry, it keeps coming up. I don't even want to talk about it. The movie doesn't even want to talk about it, by the way. We're going to talk about the tampon scene. Actually, we're not even going to talk about it, Frank. I found a video. I found a video. Before you say anything, it's not as bad as it could be. That is one of those like classic Korean animations that explains the tampon. And I don't, it's just basically just know that this is a scene from later in the book. They're just having sex, even though they don't have a legal contract to define it. and I think this will do all the work for me.
So if you're listening to this via podcast, here's what's happening on screen. He's pulling out her tampon and tossing it in the toilet. You're not missing anything, sexy. I promise.
Is all of that dialogue taken verbatim from the text?
It is. Including holy fuck. I cannot confirm Splash. Yes.
Were any plumbers offended at the suggestion you should put tampons in the toilet?
I cannot speak for the plumbers of the world. We shouldn't probably talk about tampons anymore. All right, so moving on. Okay, we got to talk about the emailing. Because a lot of their discourse, and this is actually, God, I read some terrible thing. I was like, it's groundbreaking how there's all this, so much of their communication is through email.
An epistolary novel for our age.
I know, finally. But I wanted to give you a sense of the kind of emails that they're sending back and forth to each other. And Frank, you've already agreed to do this, so I'm just going to hand it to you. Here is an abridged, a slightly abridged version of one of the emails that Christian Grey sends to you. By the way, guys, this is as close, this is the most of the text that you are ever going to have to listen to in the course of this presentation. So you're doing great. You're doing so much better than I did, actually, having to read the fucking thing. So Frank, whenever you're ready.
From Christian Grey, subject, free your mind. All those words are capitalized. Date redacted. To Anastasia Steele. So you felt demeaned, debased, abused, and assaulted. That and is an ampersand. How very Tess Durbefield of you. I believe it was you who decided on the debasement, if I remember correctly. Do you really feel like this, or do you think you ought to feel like this? Two very different things. If that is how you feel, do you think you could just try and embrace these feelings, deal with them for me? New paragraph. That's what a submissive would do. New paragraph. I am grateful for your inexperience. I value it, and I'm only beginning to understand what it means. Simply put, it means that you are mine in every way.
Oh.
New paragraph. Punishment spanking hurts far more than sensual spanking. So that's about as hard as it gets, unless you, of course, you commit some major transgression, in which case I'll use some implement to punish you with. My hand was very sore, but I like that. We are consenting adults. There's a hyphen in consenting for some reason. It's consent-ing.
The one thing I will say is that might be my fault. That might be my fault in copying it, the text down. That is the one thing I will forgive E.L. James.
And what we do behind closed doors is between ourselves. You need to free your mind and listen to your body. New paragraph. The world of M&A is not nearly as stimulating as you are, Miss Steele. No comma. Christian Grey, CEO, Grey Enterprises Holdings Incorporated. That was a work email.
All of these emails, the book is like 25% these emails, and they all end with his email signature, CEO Grey Holdings. I was reading this during the Sony hack, like, flare-up, and I could not get over it. Just every time, it's like, you are sending this from your work email account.
That's, I think, another piece of fanfiction that should be considered is Amy Pascal, Channing Tatum email exchanges that slowly take on a 50 Shades of Grey bent.
Really, we're coming up with amazing ideas.
I agree.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So any you thank you for doing that, Frank.
Oh, anytime. I love epistolary novels.
Okay, and so we're gonna get to the thing that I find most offensive about 50 Shades of Grey. We've talked about some offensive shit. Frank, it's really mean to Jacob. So, Taylor Lautner, the Jacob character.
What's with his neck?
He's in a, his neck is like that because he's in a bad place. He's being brutally mistreated by this author.
He looks like a first edition Alice in Wonderland illustration.
With amazing abs. Here's the thing. It's not just Bella and Edward who have analogs in this book. All the characters from 50 Shades of Grey are at some level. I know this because like I dug in, I was like, wait, Anna Kendrick's in the movies. Like, who does she play in 50 Shades of Grey? She's like a secretary. It's not exciting. I apologize. But the character of Jacob is very obvious. He's renamed, I believe, Jose. And Jacob in the books, I believe, in the Twilight books, please someone correct me if I'm wrong, is Native American in heritage. I've gotten some nods. Thank you, guys. Thank you for confirming this fact that apparently I needed to know. But in 50 Shades of Grey, he's Latino, which you know because about every other one of his lines of dialogue includes something like, Dios mío! Oh. He is like a rapey Speedy Gonzalez. Because his whole thing is he keeps constantly trying to like assault Bella and Edward will not. This is how bad the crossover is. Anyways, Jose in the books keeps trying to be like, I'm supposed to be with Anastasia, and then Christian shows up to save the day to prove his manly. It's one of those classic like, you know, things where it's like, oh, that's how we prove that he beats her. He beats up a man for her.
He's so like kind of a rapist, but he beats up a real rapist.
Yeah, there you go. So, but here's the thing. I mean, I feel, not that I have a strong opinion on this topic, but in the question of Team Edward versus Team Jacob, I am very firmly Team Jacob.
Oh, I'm fully Team Edward.
I mean, what? Yes.
I question your loyalty to Team Jacob if you didn't know if he was Native American.
Read the Wikipedia article. Or Wikipedia.
Yes.
I have no question about your team loyalty to Jacob, because, I mean, look at the picture with that shirt on.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Thank you for supporting me and Team Jacob. Because Team Jacob is really the only team to be on, because Team Jacob is awesome. And
They have friend chemistry. It's not love chemistry.
Yes. Is Team Jacob illegal? He's like...
They're all like 12. Yep. So, but I have actual video evidence of why I think everyone should be Team Jacob, and it's largely down to one of my all-time favorite SNL sketches that I cannot play for you in its entirety because it's already, Jesus Christ, it's already so late. You guys are doing great.
We're only on book one.
Oh, God, we're not, yeah. I'm just going to quickly show you guys why I think everyone should be Team Jacob, which is Taylor Lautner did host SNL in the year 2009. Bless his pointy little head for it, because he fully committed to one of the weirdest possible sketch scenarios you could come up with for him, which is as a rabid Team Edward fan. That would be him on the left.
Love, what is it? Can it be planned or is it fated? I believe it is. And the moment I heard Edward say, I don't have the strength to stay away from you anymore, I knew we'd be together. I'm
sorry. Does she think she's gonna end up with the fictional vampire from Twilight?
Not think. No.
Like I said, Taylor Lautner, ladies and gentlemen. He might not have won your heart, Frank, but he won mine. So, anyways, that's the thing. It's just like, why? I mean, I think the thing about Twilight is that it does a nice job of making the love triangle at least vaguely believable in terms of, like, there's an actual chance she could end up with Jacob. Like, her relationship with Jacob is definitely friend chemistry, like you said. Not that I've ever read Twilight, but I feel like at least they gave it a shot at making it.
And she's got huge obstacles to being with Edward.
Yeah. No, it makes... And so... And then just kind of, like, stripping him down to such a cheap hand puppet of a character, it made me mad.
As opposed to stripping him down to just a glorious torso. It's an injustice.
I do not disagree. Anyway, so here's the thing. I've kind of glossed over the plot of the book because they fuck for a million words. It's really boring. The second two novels basically take on, like, there's like a hole in basically Bella's new job. Not Bella, geez Louise, I keep doing that. Anastasia's new job is, you know, she's working for this guy who, of course, turns out to be evil, and he's like trying to kill Christian by, like, sabotaging his helicopter. Like you.
And is he, like, the Michael Sheen from the movies character?
I guess.
Or Dakota Fanning?
I guess maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. I should have the grid, I guess. Yes.
Is this the movie we want to see on Valentine's Day?
That is what we're getting to. The second two books seem like they have a lot more plot to them, actually. It's actually interesting. Like, there's, like, actual things happening outside of the sphere of whether or not Anastasia and Christian are going to fuck.
I know multiple people who told me they started flipping through the sex scenes to see how the plot resolved.
Yes.
What is the sex ratio from the first book to the second and third book? You know, is it, like, 17 again, or is it down, or is it more?
You know, I'm hearing murmurs about down. I would have to say I will say that there's more plot in the second two books. I have not read the second two books. There's more plot in them.
So no sex.
I think there's sex still. God, of course there's sex still, because
that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
That there's more sex.
There's more sex. Is there?
I think it was less in the first book, but there is more sex to be had. If you keep reading.
Well, there you go. Yes, the point is that you can keep going for more. I will say, here's the thing about the movie, or the first book, and what would in theory be the first movie. I can't confirm or deny how the first movie ends, but the first book ends with them breaking up. She kind of actually figures out that she is in a terrible relationship with this person who is completely fucked up. Perhaps even 50 Shades of fucked up. And her reaction is like, I don't think we should be together anymore. And she flings herself onto her bed crying, and that's the end of it. So if that's the movie that we see on Valentine's Day, for the people who see it, doesn't sound like a really super romantic movie. It sounds like a movie where a bunch of people, two pretty attractive people have sex, and then it's weird, and then they break up.
9.5 weeks spawned both a sequel and a prequel.
Based on your reading, based on these things, which do you think sounds more romantic, 9.5 weeks or 50 Shades of Grey? I mean, you can do math on this one.
Probably a tie.
Will this movie start a new baby boom?
Oh. That's a really good question. Will this movie start a new baby boom? I do not know.
Most of the women who go see this are going through menopause, so...
Most of the people going through this are going through menopause, so we're cool, is the comment from the crowd.
What do you think this book says about the relationship E.L. James has with her husband?
E.L. James and her husband, as far as I know, have a relatively normal relationship. I know that I went looking him up because I had read something about him being a TV writer. He's written a couple of like British procedurals. And he's had to give interviews explaining, I am not Christian Grey. So I don't know. She does refer to him in some of the author's notes on at least one of these versions as her master of the universe. So the thing is, like, they're spinning one story, but remember, she's also pretending that this didn't start out as Twilight fan fiction, to the point where she felt very comfortable apparently going into development meetings with executives and them asking her who her first choice was to play Christian Grey, and her saying Robert Pattinson.
Amazing.
That was her first choice to play Christian Grey. So I think we had a question in the back there.
No, I was just going to say that this film might trigger baby boom if I watch it, because I might blow up babies. That's the only thing.
Yeah, I don't know if the babies have that coming. Yes?
Do you think that it was intentional that the character Mr. Grey is also the same name of the character that James Spader plays in Secretary, since they was also Mr. Grey?
Amazing.
Oh! Whoa! Well, that the question is, the character James Spader plays in Secretary is also named Mr. Grey, which explains a lot now. Yes?
Do you think it's also a coincidence that Mr. Grey is the name of the alien that possesses Homeland and Dreamcatcher?
Jonesy?
That possesses poor Jonesy.
He's not Jonesy. Guys, if you haven't seen Dreamcatcher, I'm not even going to subject you to explaining that.
It's Tales French.
Yeah. Yes.
E.L. James ever have any apologies for Britishisms in her writing that she never fixed, like fruits and veg?
Oh, that would involve the book having been edited at all.
Put your trainers in the sink.
So the big thing about this movie is that it doesn't, as the source material does kind of genuinely blow, but. You know, in theory, you could take this basic concept and make something interesting out of it. And the one thing I do respect Universal for is they picked a pretty unconventional choice in terms of director, Sam Taylor Johnson.
Yes.
You know, who has her own what I'm assuming is a pretty interesting sex life of her own.
Are you referring to her child groom, Aaron Taylor Johnson?
Yes, her incredibly well sculpted, torsoed child bride groom. Yes, yes.
Did you also think that you would probably cast him in this movie until you realized he's too young to play Christian Grey?
I did. I was concerned that he would be an obvious choice to play Christian Grey. Actually, I did think about that, and then I'm very glad that she went a little more age appropriate. The original casting was Charlie Hunnam. Not Robert Pattinson, much to E.L. James's disappointment. But they went with this other guy named Jamie Dornan, who at that point was only known for being the lead serial killer in the British series The Fall.
Effectively plays a stalker.
Yes. Yeah, it's actually pretty effective. Actually, geez Louise, that explains that, because there are these scenes of him jogging in the trailer. For 50 Shades that are pretty much identical to scenes of him going jogging in The Fall when he's getting more ripped and trained for serial killing. So now, God, that's a really uncomfortable association in my head.
I bet his American accent sounds a lot like Robert Pattinson's American accent.
Just as good. Yeah. Here's the thing. He's kind of a boring human being. I've had a little bit of opportunity to see him speak and in various settings, like on the Golden Globes and some such, and he is just like so boring. Yes. There's a wide, wonderful world. I can take us back to the Taylor Lautner clip. We can watch that again. There's a wide, wonderful world of men who are able to hold our interest. And most importantly, there was a world of men who might have chemistry with this attractive young lady. But as this is an image I pulled from a collection of images Jezebel had pulled together called Oh Fuck, They Hate Each Other. And it's really true. If you look at a bunch of publicity stills of them together, they do not look like they enjoy each other's company or particularly want to be having sexy times with each other. It's really, and again, I think it's just a factor that these two people, I mean, it's one of those things where if like a great director was taking on this project and she had two great leads to work with, the movie might have been able to pull out of what ultimately is otherwise a tailspin. But yes.
So I don't know. Is she writing the screenplay? Because maybe they can get someone to write fanfic about 50 Shades to write the movie. Maybe they did that.
Like Tom Stoppard.
Yes. If we could have the Rosencrantz and Guilderstern are dead of 50 Shades of Grey as the base script for 50 Shades of Grey the movie, I think we'd be in business. I think we fixed it.
What's happening with Jose and the Anna Kendrick character?
I don't know. She's a secretary. He's a photographer who says, Dios mío, a lot. That's an unlikely love connection if ever I've heard one. So, Frank, it's finally time for your final thoughts. We've basically, in case it's not clear, Christian and Anastasia end up happily ever after at the very end of book three. They've had kids together. She's cured him of his fucked upness.
He doesn't make her sign a contract for the kids.
I don't think so. It's not in the original contract anyway. He'd have to file an addendum. Yes.
Do they make the kids sign any sort of?
They're toddler. The kids are toddlers at the end of the book, but who knows what 100 Shades of Grey could be like?
Has the red room been converted into a playroom?
Oh. Are we the other question here?
No, that was it.
Amy and I are often on a common wavelength.
That is true. So, Frank, what do you think?
Well, this was a grimmer and more sobering experience than I thought it was going to be.
This was a little darker.
I don't want to say I didn't have a great time.
No, of course not. But we think.
But I thought it was going to be kind of fun and frothy and a little bit naughty. But a lot of it was pretty creepy.
Congratulations, you now know what it's like to read 50 Shades of Grey.
I guess a big question for me, and we may never be able to know until you write your Shakespeare in Love style fanfic backstory. It's like, do you think E.L. James, from the beginning, I mean, she worked in PR, do you think she went in with an agenda of, I'm going to game this fanfic community system and see what I can make of it? Or do you think that she genuinely started with a, however inept, internal desire to erotically explore Bella and Edward's relationship in an alt-human fashion and just sort of, like, rode the horse where it took her?
I think the thing, and I actually, the really sad thing, not sad, interesting thing maybe, is that I can actually kind of answer that question because...
You've already written your screenplay.
Yes. But well, when I write my screenplay, it'll involve a fair amount. There's actual, like, an old fandom friend of hers who did something that you're not supposed to do, I think, in any circumstance ever on the internet, which is publish private communications. Did publish a couple of private IM conversations where E.L. James does actively refer to her readership as not a community, but her readership. Like, she... her property, you might say, that she has control over, not, say, a community that she's an active part of. And so I think at a certain point, I don't think she ever was a part of the community to be a part of the community, and it definitely seems like she actively structured her career within fandom to lead to her career post-fandom. And actually what's interesting is that the original publisher of 50 Shades of Grey was basically a self-publishing house run by people who were part of Twilight fandom. Like, they were like, we're going to create, we're all writing these stories anyway. We'll replace all the names and sell them on the internet. And so that's where it originally started. Like, she originally got published by other people who were part of the Twilight fandom, and then she got, and then it was crazy popular, and then it blew up, and after she got picked up, I think by Random House? I think that's right. But like the major publisher that eventually picked her up. So yeah, it is kind of weird. I don't know. I feel like we've done a lot more time on E.L. James's psychology than I would have expected.
I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating question. So,
while I know it's probably inappropriate to read her IM exchanges that shouldn't have been publicly disclosed, I'd be fascinated to compare their correspondence style to her fake emails in her novel.
What was her stay line?
Yeah. Right, future CEO.
Yes, what is her IM handle is really now the question.
Maybe this is off topic, but in another sense, maybe it's the natural endpoint. Do you think they'll ever reboot Baby Boom?
Which Baby Boom?
The Diane Keaton, Sam Shepard. She gets an apple orchard. It has real serious possibilities. I'd be interested.
Yeah, I do not know Baby Boom at all.
Oh, it's a wonderful record.
It's a movie.
Of a particular mid to late 80s moment. Oh, yeah.
It's a film.
Yeah.
Is this written by Nora Ephron? It feels like it's written by Nora Ephron.
I think it's by Nancy Myers. Yay. And Charles Shire. Yeah.
Oh, that explains it.
Yeah.
The dark twin of Nora Ephron.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that they will remake any movie after this movie's a big hit, as long as it spends a lot of time on the female orgasm. Yes.
Well, and then maybe something good has come out of this.
Yeah. Yeah, but the female orgasm isn't really that big a deal here.
Whoa. Here at Nerdstrong? Because I don't accept it.
Here at Nerdstrong, we are all about the female orgasm. Yeah. Oh, good Lord. I think, Frank, that brings us to the end. We've gotten to the Baby Boom reference. And that's about it. So, yes, that's the end. Thank you so much, you guys. We got a special thanks. Thank Dave and Matt for producing tonight. We got to thank Andrew Deutsch and Nerdstrong for hosting us. Everyone who helped me with the research on this, because this one required research, you guys.
Go to Wikipedia.
Yes. I will show you in the book where I've highlighted it. It literally says. It's so awful. A special applause to our bellmaster, Amy. Our live trader, Kim. Thank you for listening. As always, if you have not, you must check out Lost Moon Radio for all of Frank's delightfulness. And thank you guys for sticking with us. Yay! In your eyes,
I touch on you more and more. Thus concludes Liz Tells Frank Live. For more information about Liz Tells Frank, please visit liztellsfrank.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and sign up for updates. Those will be updates about important things, like when you might be able to experience the next Liz Tells Frank Live.